This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief over at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 33 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. I sent out an innocent tweet on Sunday night that said, "What's the argument for Rob Kelly this year?" I genuinely wanted to know because I kind of assumed that Samaje Perine's average draft position would be a lot higher than it is at this point in the offseason. You've got a good offense that should score a decent amount of points in Washington, and the starting running back, Rob Kelly, is basically a fullback who ran the ball 318 times for 1,270 yards and 6 touchdowns in 4 years at Tulane. He had a 4.0 yards per carry average at Tulane. During his final season there, he was out-attempted by Dontrell Hilliard and Sherman Beatty. Who? Exactly. Now, I'm not the type of analyst who clings on to college production for years and years despite that unproductive college player being productive at an NFL level. We've seen players who don't do a ton in college do something in the NFL. If that weren't the case, then we'd never see undrafted free agents become something. But I also want to be cognizant of outliers, which Rob Kelly would have to be in order to be a truly productive asset in the NFL. As it stands, Kelly is the starter in Washington, so when I asked that question, the majority of responses included that in the answer. To be fair, though, I'd expect that to be the case. He was at least reliable from the standpoint that he didn't give up the ball like Matt Jones did for Washington last year, and his competition is a receiving back in Chris Thompson, as well as a rookie. Why would he not be at the top of the depth chart? The other response to the question was that Kelly wasn't all that bad for Washington last year. But I don't know if I really agree with that. Last season, Kelly got his first big start against Cincinnati in Week 8, where he ran the ball 21 times for 87 yards. He then saw double-digit carries in 8 of his final 9 games. That type of volume made him an RB2 in fantasy over that stretch, because you basically need to have a pulse while getting volume to be an RB2 in fantasy football. Kelly's success rate, a metric we use at NumberFire that determines the percentage of positive expected point runs a running back gets, was just 37.5% last year. That was the worst rate of any Washington back, and that includes Matt Jones, who was far better than anyone gave him credit for last season. He just couldn't hold on to the ball. On top of this, his production fell as the season went on last year. You may credit that to just random variance, which is super valid, but you could also potentially say that it has to do with the fact that he's not an every down back and he's never been an every down back. During Kelly's first 3 starts, he carried the ball 67 times for 321 yards, good for a 4.79 yards per carry average. Over his final 6 games, he toted the rock 84 times for a 3.33 yards per carry average. Maybe that's variance, but maybe that's a body breaking down. This all leads me to Samaje Perine. He's RB34 according to fantasyfootballcalculator.com's ADP data, while Rob Kelly is RB38. Now, I know MFL 10 data might not say the same thing, and maybe another draft that you did doesn't say the same thing either. The discrepancy is probably larger, but I'm trying to speak to a bigger audience here and how home drafts might go. When the ADP is that tight, and when you're in the middle rounds, I have no idea why you wouldn't just go for the ambiguous rookie who smashes the incumbent from a production profile and athleticism standpoint. I don't even like Samaje Perine as a prospect either. He was a below average runner in my model. But we're also comparing Perine to a player who profiles like Matt Asiata. And we're also comparing Perine to a player we know won't be catching a ton of passes out of the backfield, especially with Chris Thompson there. Like, I get it. Chris Thompson's presence in that situation as a whole may not lead to any of these backs being very viable in fantasy football. I don't even disagree with that. But why would you not go for the guy who at least has some semblance of a profile that looks like a lead back at the NFL? Or the guy who, since he's a rookie, might have upside that wasn't fully understood during the evaluation process? Because I'm going to be wrong, and so are you. And the probability of me being wrong about a player like Samaje Perine is going to be a lot greater than the probability of me being wrong about a player like Rob Kelly, because Samaje Perine is objectively a better prospect than Rob Kelly is. Here's my final take on this Kelly thing, though. If there's a huge discrepancy in your league between the two guys, and Kelly is like an 11th rounder while Perine is a 6th rounder, then sure, I get it. Snag Rob Kelly. But if their ADPs are closer together in any way, let alone close together in the middle or later rounds, I have no clue why you would not want to draft Samaje Perine over Rob Kelly. And the reason I bring all this up is because P. Ryan was actually one of the 13 players in an article I did over on NumberFire this past week on the most underrated players in fantasy football drafts. I'm going to rank those players on today's podcast from 10 to 1, so a few of them will be knocked off the list. And that includes P. Ryan, because I don't think he's as much of a screaming bargain as some of these other players. But this specific show will look a lot like what I'm going to be doing in season. There's less evergreen stuff to be done then, and you thirsty listeners want specific player analysis and game theory advice for the current season. I know this. This show will be a lot like, for instance, the 15 transaction show that I plan on doing each Tuesday during the regular season. So after you're done listening to me talk about these 10 players, I'd love to hear what you think. Hit me up on Twitter, @LateRoundQB, and let me know. But without further ado, let's start things off by looking at the 10th most underrated player in fantasy drafts this year. At number 10, I've got Pierre Garçon. I'm really not into the Kyle Shanahan feeding his top receiver narrative like I talked about on the last show. But Garçon is going to be peppered with targets in the 49ers offense this year, and I do think he has a realistic 140 to 150 target ceiling in the offense. That alone makes him well worth a wide receiver 39 price tag. The downside with Garçon is scoring. As much as I think Brian Hoyer is underrated as a real passer, the last time he and Shanahan were together, that was back in 2014 with the Browns, Cleveland threw just 12 touchdowns all season long. Even with a hefty market share in the scoring department, Garçon could struggle to find the end zone. That's especially true when you consider that Garçon's never been much of a scorer, as he's never scored more than 6 times in a single season. I like Garçon a lot, but I do know that there are fantasy experts out there who like him even more than I do. Nevertheless, he's a good value according to fantasyfootballcalculator.com's ADP. Jaquizz Rodgers comes in at number 9, and for some, you may have to change the way that your brain thinks about fantasy football to comprehend this one fully. As I always say, fantasy football is a weekly game. It's not a yearly one. With Doug Martin suspended for 3 games to start the year, Quiz is more than likely going to be the dude who carries the load for the Bucks. In 5 games in which he saw a large market share of the team's carries last year, so I'm looking at games with 15 or more attempts, he tallied 462 rushing yards and a 4.32 yards per carry average, finishing as a top 18 fantasy running back in 4 of those contests. He was very good last year. Among the 69 running backs with 50 or more attempts a season ago, Rodgers was 11th in success rate. Doug Martin, meanwhile, was 58th. Peyton Barber was 59th. And Charles Sims was 65th. That's a pretty significant difference. Zero RBers should love him because he's a cheap early season starter. But I also think there's a possibility that Doug Martin comes back and Doug Martin is the Martin of old. I know reports are saying the opposite, and I'm certainly not banking on that fact. I'm just banking on Rodgers being the starter there for 3 weeks, which still makes him a value in and of itself at his ADP. But the upside is there if Martin is his 2016 self, and that makes Jaquizz Rodgers an even more enticing option. At number 8 on the most underrated list, I've got Kenny Britt, because Kenny Britt is very good at football. Can I just leave the analysis at that? In all seriousness, it was amazing that Britt was able to be competent and useful with Jared Goff under center last season. Britt was so good last season that he actually posted close to the same yards after the catch per catch rate as Tavon Austin, despite the fact that his air yards per catch average was more than 2.5 times the size of Austin's. In other words, even though Britt was catching passes down the field, he was doing close to as much after the catch as Tavon Austin was, when it's far easier to do that closer to the line of scrimmage where Tavon Austin was. That's partially because Tavon Austin might not be very good, but I think it's just as much, if not more, of Britt being very strong. Now he's in Cleveland where the situation is a tad better from a passing perspective, and he should be able to capture between 22 to 25% of the team's market share given the weapons and the inexperienced weapons in that offense. Why that high of a market share? Well, Corey Coleman's prorated market share alongside Terrell Pryor's last year would have hit the 45-ish percent range, so it only makes sense for Coleman and Britt to be along those same lines. That means you're getting 130 or so targets at wide receiver 53, which is absurd even in an offense with questionable, albeit very underrated, quarterback play. That's right, I'm on Team Cody Kessler. The first and only quarterback on this list is actually not Andy Dalton, whom I've touted a bit on this show and on the interweb. Instead, I want to talk about Carson Palmer. The main reason for it is because he's going even later than Dalton, and I'm really in love with Palmer's early season schedule. But first, let's just talk about Palmer himself. He was a top 5 fantasy quarterback 2 years ago, and that year he totaled a league-high 2,897 air yards on completed passes. As a result, he threw 13 touchdowns that traveled 15 or more yards through the air. Last season, his air yards profile dropped to about 2,600 yards, which was still fine in the fourth most in the league thanks to the vertical Bruce Arians offense, but he scored just 6 touchdowns on throws that went 15 plus air yards. Doing some aggression analysis on air yards, Palmer should have thrown 3.8 more touchdowns on those types of throws last year. Among 212 quarterbacks with 200 or more attempts over the last 6 years, that's the 11th largest discrepancy in the wrong direction. So some positive regression, or progression, since people get really pissed off when I say positive regression, should be in store for Palmer, especially considering John Brown should be healthy. More on him in a second, though. The main reason I wanted to point out Palmer here, aside from the fact that he's in a good offense that will score points and throw the ball downfield, and he's already shown to have upside, all good things for fantasy football, is that he has a great early season schedule. The Cardinals open up with the Lions in week 1, then they get the Colts in week 2, then the Cowboys, and then the 49ers. All of those should be plus matchups. So if you're a quarterback streamer, you're not just getting a player who has a lot of upside, but you're getting one who has a nice early season schedule. And that is a beautiful thing. At number 6 is Sammy Watkins. As much as I hate data extrapolation, Watkins' numbers over the last 2 years with Tyrod Taylor, on average, would have yielded about 113 targets per season, 67 receptions, 1,125 yards, and over 8 touchdowns. Those are fringe wide receiver 1 numbers, and those are numbers from a player who's played injured for plenty of weeks. With little competition there for volume, if he's healthy, and I get it, that's a big if, Watkins could be in store for a lot of work. And while he's in more of the volatile category like Dez Bryant week to week, you can easily make the case that he should be drafted ahead of Dez, given Dez's potential in-season matchups this year. Watkins does fall in some drafts, and if he makes it to the late third round, I am all about that life, especially if I have him as a wide receiver 2 on my squad instead of a wide receiver 1. My man Ty Montgomery comes in at number 5. It's important to note that I do like him more in PPR formats naturally because he's a converted wide receiver playing the running back position. But I do like Ty Mon a lot this year. Last year, he saw at least 40% of Green Bay snaps in 9 of his 15 games played. And in those games, he averaged 7.89 carries, 49.56 rushing yards, 0.33 rushing touchdowns, 5.78 targets, 4.44 receptions, and 36.11 receiving yards per contest. In PPR formats, that's roughly 15 fantasy points per outing, which would have made him a top 10 running back last year. Montgomery was good from just about any metric that you look at, and he ranked 16th in the league last season in success rate among all running backs, which is pretty impressive for a dude who wasn't even a running back to start the season. Some people are worried about Jamal Williams and maybe Aaron Jones, and just so it's out there, my model does like Aaron Jones more than Jamal Williams, but the Packers had no depth chart going into the draft, hence their 3 running back draft picks in the later rounds. Montgomery doesn't need a ton of volume to be relevant either, so there's some room for those guys to still get some work in. Given the offense that he's in, his performance last year, and the honest lack of big competition, I love Montgomery's upside this season in the Packers offense, especially as an RB2 in my fantasy squad. I mentioned him earlier, but John Brown comes in at number 4 on this list. Brown suffered from his sickle cell trait last year, and it definitely showed. He had nearly the exact same air yards per catch profile from the previous year. He had 10.49 air yards per catch versus 10.46 in 2016, but his yards after the catch dropped from 4.94 in 2015 to, get this, 2.79. That, to me, is screaming at us, telling us all that he was probably ineffective due to that injury. Like I said with Carson Palmer, the Cardinals offense should score points, and with no Michael Floyd, Brown isn't competing with a lot of established dudes for targets in that offense. If he can stay healthy, again, this is an if, because some beat writers in Arizona are still worried about the sickle cell issue, Brown should be able to eclipse 110 targets. And considering they'll be down the field ones, that makes him a really, really good value pick as a later round wideout. Speaking of down the field threats, Ted Ginn is getting no love from you guys this season. He comes in at number 3 on this list. Essentially, even if Ted Ginn sees a lower percentage of his team's targets in New Orleans versus what he saw in Carolina, it should balance out with what he did in Carolina, given the Saints haven't thrown the ball fewer than 600 times since Barack Obama's first year in office. 100 targets is actually very in reach for Ginn with Brandon Cooks gone. In fact, I have Ginn currently projected for almost 100 targets with a 15% market share in that offense. The team that he's on is a dream for what he does. He's a deep threat, and Drew Brees was 8th in the NFL last season in pass attempts that traveled 15 or more yards through the air, ending the season with the most passing yards in football on those types of throws. And this is not anything new. He's been in the top four in deep ball yards since 2011. So not only is Ginn going to see a decent amount of volume if he can stay healthy, but he has Drew Brees, the deep ball specialist, tossing him the rock. I love this fit for Ted Ginn, and I think he's going to be far more viable in fantasy football than his ADP currently suggests. Number two on the list of most underrated players is my favorite breakout tight end candidate, and that's Eric Ebron. Ebron's been far better than most give him credit for so far in his career. And despite scoring just a single touchdown last year, he was still a usable low-end tight end one in PPR formats. He would have been a higher-end tight end two in most other seasons, but with one touchdown, there's nothing wrong with that. A huge reason I like Ebron, aside from the fact that he's done a lot in the league at a young age, is that Anquan Boldin's gone. Boldin played the majority of his snaps from the slot last year, and he actually finished second in the league in red zone targets and third in targets from within the opponent's 10-yard line. With Ebron playing in that area of the field, despite the fact that he's never been a huge touchdown scorer, including college, you have to be a little intrigued. That's on top of the fact that they don't necessarily have a locked-in red zone threat in that offense, and Detroit outlets are also talking about him playing a bigger role in the red zone as well. We see tight ends break out all of the time in fantasy football, especially athletic tight ends. And of the later round guys this season, I think Ebron's the best bet in that Lions offense. My number one dude as the most undervalued is the most boring, logical, stupid pick possible. I talked about him on last week's mailbag episode, and it's Frank Gore. No, it's doubtful that Gore will be a, quote, league winner for your squad this year. But what even is a league winner? Gore is still very usable in fantasy football, and his depressed ADP just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Last year, Gore was 13th in top 12 performances at the running back position, 8th in top 18 ones, and 8th in top 24 RB2 performances among all running backs. He was basically a high-end RB2 at worst. This year, his average draft position is in the 7th round as RB33, even though the Colts only selected Marlon Mack during the draft, who might honestly end up being more of a scat back at the NFL level. Gore doesn't have competition, and he's led the league in attempts over the last 2 years combined. And he's already broken the age curve, guys. The discount on Gore right now, 1,000,000%, has to do with his age. But he's already in elite company when it comes to age. At 33, he carried the ball 263 times, the fifth highest total for any running back aged 33 or older. And he hit the 1,000-yard mark last year too, becoming the third running back to do so at 33 years or older. If this is the year that Frank Gore finally falls apart, then so be it. I spent a 7th or 8th rounder on the guy. It's really not that big of a deal. But let's also not forget that we've been talking about it being Frank Gore's last year since before the song Gangnam Style came out. That's it for the list though, guys. Again, I'd love feedback on this format, so send any feedback over to me on Twitter at LateRoundQB. And while you do that, please do me a huge favor and subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and leave a review. It helps me out tremendously. I'll be back in your ears on Friday with a mailbag episode, everyone. Until then, draft Frank Gore.